First Kings chapter 18. We'll begin reading in verse 1 and read through verse 39. First Kings chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. Now it happened after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go, show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by fifties in a cave and provided them with bread and water. Then Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we will find grass and keep the horses and mules alive and not have to kill some of the cattle." So they divided the land between them to survey it. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. Now as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him, and he recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is this you, Elijah, my master?" He said to him, "It is I. Go and say to your master, 'Behold, Elijah is here.'" He said, "What sin have I committed that you're giving your servant into the hand of Ahab to put me to death? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my master is not sent to search for you." And when they said, "He is not here," he made the kingdom or nation swear that they could not find you. And now you are saying, "Go, say to your master, 'Behold, Elijah is here.' It will come about when I leave you that the Spirit of the Lord will carry you where I do not know. So when I come and tell Ahab and he cannot find you, he will kill me, although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. Has it not been told to my master that I did what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, that I hid 100 prophets of the Lord by fifties in a cave and provided them with bread and water? And now you're saying, 'Go say to your master, behold, Elijah is here.' He will then kill me." Elijah said, "As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is this you, you troubler of Israel?" He said, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you have followed the Baals. Now then, send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent a message among all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him." But the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, "I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now let them give us two oxen, and let them choose one ox for themselves, and cut it up, and place it on the wood, and put no fire under it, and I will prepare the other ox, and lay it on the wood, and I will not put a fire under it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I'll call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people said, "That's a good idea." So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one ox for yourselves and prepare it first, for you are many. And call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it." Then they took the ox which was given them, and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "Oh, Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped about the altar which they made. It came about noon that Elijah mocked them and said, "Call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he's occupied, or perhaps he's asleep and needs to be awakened." So they cried with a loud voice and cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances until blood gushed out on them. When midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. But there was no voice. No one answered. and no one paid attention. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Israel shall be your name." So with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. At the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me that this people may know you, O Lord our God, and that you have turned their heart back again." Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." Well, it's not the first Lord's Day of the new year, but I suppose it's close enough to the new year that people still have things like good intentions on their minds with regard to the new calendar year. It's not a bad time at all to take and consider those things that we need to give more attention to. I don't know that it's necessarily a hugely positive thing to have a lot of New Year's resolutions. I suppose if you like breaking things, then it's good to have a lot of resolutions. But nonetheless, it is a good opportunity for us, spiritually speaking, especially, to reevaluate our lives, to consider those areas where we might need to be or where we need to be more intentional with giving time and effort. Now, if we're going to think spiritually only, there's a number of areas. I'm assuming that everyone would admit that they probably should have sought the Lord better with the reading of his word in the past year. I don't think anyone is willing to stand up and say, "I am perfectly content with how much I sought the Lord through the reading of the scriptures in the past year." I'm guessing that everybody would desire to improve with regard to that. Or making an effort to meet with the Lord's people on a regular basis, or the area of giving, or the area of prayer, which is what I want to consider this morning. Again, like reading the scriptures, I'm guessing that not many of us are willing to stand up and say, "You know what, if my prayer life is the same this year as it was last year, then that's okay. I'm very content with where it is." My expectation is that if you belong to the Lord, you desire to move forward in communing with him. You would like to do a better job, be able to focus more in the midst of praying, that you would more regularly carry needs to the Lord. So, though there are plenty of other things that we could give our time and attention to with regard to thinking about, things to consider for the new year, prayer is likely applicable to us all. And so what I want to do is use teaching from Jesus on prayer, but not so much how to pray. I would like to take just a few verses from Matthew 6 in the Sermon on the Mount and attempt to learn from Jesus how to not pray poorly. So the title this morning is Praying Poorly. Not how to pray poorly, I hope. How to avoid it. In the midst of the Sermon on the Mount, in chapter 6 particularly, it's right in the middle of the sermon, and Jesus is covering three assumed activities of Christians: giving, praying, and fasting. And I say assumed activities because each of the sections here begin not with "if you give," or "if you pray," or "if you fast," but each section from Jesus begins in this way: "when you give." He actually repeats that twice. Or "when you pray," three times. And "when you fast." Again, it's mentioned twice. So when Jesus is teaching in this extended sermon here, the longest sermon that we have from our Lord, he's not suggesting that those who desire to follow him pray. He's assuming that they pray, and he's giving instructions to them on how to pray better. My assumption is that all of us would like to hear that, to sit at the feet of Jesus and hear him how to help us. Help us to pray. He assumes that we'll be a praying people. He not only assumes that we'll be a praying people, he assumes that we could use help in our praying, which is why he offers these words for us in Matthew chapter 6. Look at verses 5 through 8 of Matthew chapter 6. "When you pray, you're not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners so that they may be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who's in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. So do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him." In teaching us how to pray better, Christ begins with the concrete, easy-to-understand examples, three of them particularly, of how not to pray. He does the same thing with regard to giving and fasting. The same type of help is offered. Don't sound a trumpet, he says, when you're giving. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, or when you're fasting. Don't put on a gloomy face. He's contrasting in these examples the reason or motivation, the incentive for our devotion, with the reward. With regard to praying, we see it here. They have their reward in full. If you're doing it just as a show, you'll get the reward. But if you want to be pleasing to the Lord, then do it in the way that Christ has commanded. Immediately following these few verses that we're looking at this morning, you may be able to tell, as we've just read those, is the Lord's Prayer. So right on the back end of Jesus clarifying how not to pray, then he goes ahead and tells us how to pray. In fact, in Luke's account of the Lord's Prayer, you may remember, it's been over a year ago that we looked at it, I think, but it includes the request from his disciples. I mean, they come to him and say, "Lord, teach us how to pray." And again, I find this encouraging. It's always encouraging to realize and to be reminded that Jesus' disciples, who had walked with him daily, who had watched him turn water into wine, they had seen him heal the sick with a word or with a touch, they had watched him multiply bread and fish, and when they come to him, they ask, "Teach us how to pray." They evidently noticed the definite link between the prayer life of Jesus and his teaching, his authority, his power, his character. They recognized that it was the relationship that he had with his Father that was primary, that the rest of his life flowed out of. So there's much to learn from Jesus with regard to praying. So for our sakes this morning, I mentioned the title's Praying Poorly. The subtitle continues with the wonderful alliteration: Pretending Prayer, Pagan Prayer, and Parentless Prayer. First, pretending prayer. When you pray, you're not to be like the hypocrites. Now, there's a tendency when we read passages like this, passages that so clearly expose hypocrisy and condemn Pharisaism, there's a huge tendency and proneness in us to not see the immense relevance for ourselves. It is easy to read a passage that says, "Don't be like the hypocrites," and for every one of us to think, okay, that means don't be like that person, that person, that person, that person. we might as well read it like this. When you pray, don't be like you've been. We have to work hard to avoid the danger of missing the primary point of Christ's teaching here on prayer. He is exposing the terrible effects of sin on our souls. Particularly this, sin in the form of selfishness and pride. What Jesus points out for us here in his warning to not pray like a hypocrite, he's pointing out for us that sin is so wicked, so bold, that it will follow us even to the gates of heaven. Why wouldn't it? The scriptures tell us that's where its origin is. It would love to disrupt everything there again. So in our attempt to go to the throne of God, to the gates of heaven, to the feet of the cross, to the throne, sin will bother us there. It follows us there as long as we're in these fallen bodies. Sin is described or identified here with Jesus' teaching as self-worship. That's what's at stake. That's what the hypocrites are doing. That's our danger in prayer, is not going to the Lord for his sake, but going for our own sake, that we might be seen as something. When we're simply going through the motions of worship, it is possible, even quite likely, that we're actually not worshiping God, but worshiping ourselves. When you pray, you're not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray. They love to pray? Not really. Not to really pray, nor do they love God. They love themselves, and they love praise from others. Therefore, they love to stand and to be seen as spiritual, as prayers. They desire applause from man rather than attention from God. Nothing will destroy prayer like focusing on human spectators. Right? You've felt it. We know this experientially. And at the same time, nothing enriches prayer like a sense of the presence of God. Isn't he who we want to draw near to? He's the one who's going to provide help. Attention-seeking methods and distracting deeds are self-serving, self-worship tactics that have no place in the worship of God, in the God of the Bible. The hypocrite that Jesus is warning us about is consumed with being known. Known as the one who prays. The hypocrite desires that his or her reputation be a man of prayer, a woman of prayer. The hypocrite prays publicly with the intention of affecting the hearers rather than approaching God with reverence. Jesus uses the term hypocrite here. It's worth us understanding exactly what is meant by it. A hypocrite is an actor in a play, a legitimate actor in a dramatic production. In the Greek theater, there was someone who wore a mask in order to conceal their actual identity. Jesus is saying, be real. Be genuine. Don't pretend that you're something you're not. Avoid praying poorly by avoiding pretending in prayer. In our context, just like in the days of Jesus, a hypocrite is someone who's not using the stage to be an actor, but is using the world as their stage, casting themselves in the starring role. Look at me. Watch me. Notice me. We have to be careful not to miss the primary intent of Jesus here. When he says they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on street corners, he is not condemning standing to pray. Right? That's not the issue. Samuel records for us that Hannah stood while praying for a son at the temple. Jesus assumed that his disciples would stand and pray. Mark 11:25, whenever you stand praying, forgive. If you have anything against anyone, so that your Father who is in heaven will also forgive you. Standing to pray is not what's being warned against here. Neither is praying in the synagogue. Jesus himself went to the synagogue. Luke 19:46, he even called the synagogue a house of prayer while he was there that day. Praying on the street corners is not what Jesus is warning against. Jesus prayed in all kinds of public places. The tomb of Lazarus is an easy one for us. The example, when he prayed, "Lazarus, come forth." The problem of hypocritical or pretending prayers is not what is being prayed or where it's being prayed. The problem with hypocrites is why they are praying. Jesus tells us the why. So that they may be seen by men. They love to pray because they're being noticed. They're standing to pray so that they can be noticed. They're going to the public arena so that they can be noticed. Being seen praying, again, is not the main issue here. But practicing our deeds, specifically praying, with the purpose of being seen is exactly the warning here. The hypocrite does not want to be holy. The hypocrite does, however, want to be seen as holy. This is a great measuring gauge for us. How much of our pursuit of God is a pursuit of holiness? And how much of our pursuit is wanting to be seen by others as holy? Are we attempting to be like Christ, or are we desiring to be seen as being like Christ? The pretender is not concerned about being righteous. However, the pretender is very concerned about having a reputation for righteousness. Would you rather be seen by everyone as righteous? Or would you rather stand before God robed in the righteousness of his Son? They aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. However, we must be careful that we are not simply pretending, but that we are pursuing Christ for Christ's sake. Now, does this warning, especially the second part in verse 6, when you pray, go into your inner room, close the door, pray to your Father who's in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Does this prohibit public prayer? Does it deem corporate prayer meetings like we've just had this morning useless? Not at all. There's an expectation that we will be private prayers. But if we look down just to verse 9 and see when Jesus begins teaching us how to pray, it is our Father. It's in the plural. There's an expectation that we're going to be together and praying. Acts 2:42. They were continually devoting themselves to prayer when they gathered together. There are principles that must be applied both in public and in private praying. I've summarized three of them. To help avoid praying poorly by being pretenders in prayer. The first is forget others. Not completely. Obviously, we're going to be praying for others some in our prayers, and it matters that others are around us, how they're affected when we're praying publicly. But I mean forget others in this way. We care far too much what others think. Anyway, and the real issue is not that we care so much what others think. The real problem is we care too much about ourselves, which is the second helpful point. Not just forget others, but forget yourself. We are unquestionably far too self-aware, self-consumed, self-absorbed. So forgetting others as far as what they think, and forgetting ourselves, not focusing on self exclusively, and then focusing on God. If we're blinded with the preoccupation about what others think about us, it will prove utterly impossible for us to focus on God in any way that's pleasing to him or helpful in our prayer life. If we seek the approval of men in our praying, we can be certain that that's all we will get. Truly, I say to you, those who pray so that they may be seen by men, last line of verse 5, truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. Their reward is so full, there's no room for God to see anything pleasing in them. So the options are, we can have the approval of men, if that's what we're seeking, or the acceptance of God. Men's approval is so short-lived. God's acceptance knows no end. Why not pursue Him? One commentator that's died in the last few years said this, prayers which are meant for the ears of others will never reach the ears of God. Not that He can't hear, but that He's not listening. So pretending prayer, avoiding praying poorly. Secondly, pagan prayer. When you're praying, verse 7, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles or pagans do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. Now again, we need to point out what the issue is by noticing what it's not. The primary issue with pagan style praying is not that there are too many words. Wordiness is not what Jesus is warning against. The concerning problem is that they suppose their many words will earn them a hearing with God. As if somehow God only hears long prayers. Pagan prayers are often used like good luck charms, full of empty phrases, meaningless mantras, mind-numbing manipulation, magic potion type repetition of vanity. What's missing, what Jesus is focusing on here, what's missing with real prayer that is often exemplified by pagan-style praying that Jesus is warning against is the engagement of the mind and the heart. Now listen, repetition is not a bad thing necessarily. Jesus is not saying do not be repetitive in your praying. He's not condemning repetition. Look closely. He condemns meaningless repetition. He's not condemning lengthy prayers. They are not inherently long. It is not necessarily wrong to pray long prayers. He's not condemning wordy prayers. He condemns many words as a motive for prayer. This is wonderfully understood by the illustration that we looked at in our reading from 1 Kings 18. Elijah is making a point that there is one true God. And he sets the stage. Gather all your prophets together. It's 450 to 1. Gather on Mount Carmel. This is where Baal is worshipped regularly. He's outnumbered. He's in their own territory. And he says, you take the first ox, you prepare it, you call on your God, let's see what happens. And all day long, the prophets prayed. From morning to noon, from noon to evening. Halfway through, they're allowed and out. Elijah mocks them. Where is your God? Why can't he hear you? Do you need to wake him up? What's going on? Nothing. They lift their voice. They cut themselves. They jump around, lots of movement, action. It's all pagan. It's not real. God hasn't moved. He hasn't shown up. And then Elijah repairs the altar. He sets it up using 12 stones, making a point there. Actually, the kingdom had been divided. He was making a point that it actually should not be divided. God had said there would be 12 tribes. He puts all 12 stones there. He prepares the sacrifice. In order to make his point even stronger, he douses it with water once, twice, three times. It's overflowing. And then prays, verse 36, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have turned their heart back again. 12 seconds, 15 seconds worth of simple, focused, heart and mind engaged prayer, trusting in God. Verse 38, then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, Baal worshipers until this point, denying that there was a true God in Israel, fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. Simple requests made to God are the only requirement. God doesn't need lengthy explanations. Listen, if you're struggling in your prayer life, if you want your prayer life to be better this year, don't overcomplicate it. Your prayers should be frequent. They should be fervent. But it is not necessary that they be fancy. Avoid praying poorly by avoiding pagan prayers. And then finally, verse 8, do not be like them. Then begins the next point, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Parentless praying. More specifically, fatherless praying. Don't pray like an orphan. When there's hesitation and reluctancy in asking for what we need, it displays a distrust in our all-knowing Father who has promised to give us everything that we ask for. Again, a helpful illustration from 2 Samuel 9 in the story of Mephibosheth. Is there anyone left in the house of Saul, David asked, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? David had made a covenant before the Lord. He had promised that he would take care and serve. A servant of the house of Saul said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan who is crippled in both feet. Sounds inconvenient. It's easy to keep the covenant if there's no cost involved or minimal cost. But King David, keeping his word, sent and brought him, Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan. The son of Saul came to David, fell on his face, prostrated himself. David said, Mephibosheth. And he said, here is your servant. David said to him, do not fear. These are enemies. Longtime enemies, Mephibosheth expected, here it is. My time has come. David says, do not fear. I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father, Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land of your grandfather, Saul, and you shall eat at my table regularly. David is king at this point. You who are an enemy are coming to the king's table. Fear no more. Come and dine with me. Again, Mephibosheth prostrated himself and said, what is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me? David called Saul's servant and said to him, all that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him. You shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat at my table regularly. Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of the king's son. In the final verse in that chapter, 2 Samuel 9, so Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate at the king's table regularly. Now he was lame in both feet. As children of the living God, once enemies, now, dining with him at his table, we must be convinced of God being our Father. And not just a father who's struggling to provide, but a king who owns it all. We must be convinced of the unending provision that is ours in Christ. We must be convinced of all the benefits that Christ has purchased for us and that he has sent the Holy Spirit in order to apply them to our souls. Now, when we talk about God being a father, it's popular for us to think about God being the father of everyone, of all people. But that's not this kind of fatherhood. This is exclusive. This is restricted. It's not fatherhood with regard to creation, but to redemption. God is the father of all those who look to Jesus as their mediator, all those who consider Christ as their sin bearer, all those who go to God through Jesus alone. It's those and those alone who have the right to call God Father. Jesus teaches his disciples to address God the way that he does. John 17, Jesus is praying publicly for others to hear, and a half a dozen times he addresses God as his Father. In fact, every prayer recorded from Jesus, he addresses him as Father, except for one. Even when Jesus tells us here in verse 9, as he begins what we know is the Lord's Prayer, he begins, "Our Father." Not for the sake of protocol, but for the sake of truth. It's not just etiquette, it's obedience. So that we remember at least two things as we approach God in prayer. Remembering the who, our Father. Remembering him, we're addressing God who is our Father. And remembering who we are, the ones doing the addressing. Who we were apart from him and who he has made us through the work of Christ. We must be aware of who we're talking to and who we are doing the talking. He's our Father. Your Father knows what you need before you ask him. So we expect the next line to say, so you don't even have to ask him because he already knows. But that's not what Jesus says. He says he knows before you ask him. Here's how to ask. Our Father who is in heaven. So much is wrapped up in this wonderful word. The fact that he's our Father means that we've been adopted, that we belong to him, that we've been saved from our former father who seeks to kill, steal, and destroy. The fact that he's our Father means that we, as non-Jews particularly, have been grafted in, tenderly yet definitely grafted into God's family, and we belong now. The fact that he's our Father means that reconciliation has happened. I've mentioned it already this morning. We were enemies of his. And now we sit with him in his family, day in and day out. The way that we avoid praying poorly is to avoid being pretenders in prayer, to avoid being pagan-like in our praying, and to avoid praying as if we have no parent, particularly a father. So to avoid praying poorly, don't pray like a hypocrite. Or be real. It's going to be a lot easier for us going away. You may remember the great points because they are alliterated. But the last thing you need in going to the Lord in prayer is a long list of what not to do. Right? So I'm going to end with what to do now that we've spent all our time focusing on what not to do. Okay? Don't pray like a hypocrite. This is simple. Be real. Don't pray like a pagan. Again, it's simple. Be genuine. Be concise. Be believing. And don't pray like an orphan, but be certain of his care for you. Avoid hypocritical pretending. Avoid pagan-like meaningless repetition. And avoid assuming or acting like you do not have a Father in heaven who loves you. Don't pray with the intent or purpose of being noticed. Don't pray with a concern of being seen or known as a prayer. Don't pray with a notion that many words are going to earn you a hearing. Don't pray with reluctant hesitation that will expose a lack of trust. But go to God as your Father, as his child, believing him, trusting him, hoping only in him, which will be far easier the more we know about him. So spending time with him will generate and cultivate this desire and confidence of going to him. So may God help us all, individually as well as collectively, to avoid praying poorly by focusing on who God is as our Father and what Christ has accomplished for us and who he is as our elder brother, as our great advocate, and who the Spirit is as our helper. Like with anything else, if there's going to be any progress spiritually in our life, it really simply comes down to this. If we know him better, we will progress forward. How willing are we to humble ourselves and to pursue him? Because getting to know him will result in us being real with him, and being genuine and believing and certain of the care that he has for us. Let's close in prayer. God, we thank you that you are our Father, a Father who never leaves or forsakes us, a Father who has loved us from eternity past, a Father who is unchanging and will love us for all of eternity to come. We thank you for what is ours in Christ, that though once we were lost and uninterested in you, that you conquered us with your love, revealed the need that we have to know you, and you saved us. God, how we long to walk closely with you. We thank you for the privilege of prayer, the opportunity to live ever before you, moment by moment. God, will you help us? We desire as your children to walk close with you, particularly in prayer. Will you aid us? For Christ's sake.